yelled, or tried to, but I felt the wind rushing out of the room rather quickly. Then he said, "Iris Burton, you better impress me." This was in response to Iris's reputation. One of her famous quotes was, "I don't eat steak, I eat filet mignon." These guys were definitely hamburger men casting a hamburger movie, and moreover, they all knew it. "We were shocked when we got a submission from Iris," the one woman among them said, obviously trying to lighten the mood. But they didn't get a submission from Iris. The culprit behind that submission was standing before them. "So," the first dickish guy said, "we need you to do an accent with this, a British accent. Can you do an accent?" "Actually," I said, "I'd like to try it with a French accent." They all looked at each other. "Okay," the dickish guy said, the disdain in his voice making it clear he wasn't expecting much. "Go for it." They'd placed facsimiles of all the puppets on the floor. So I sat down and started playing with them, saying my lines with a French accent. I was used to playing with Star Wars figures, so that's what I pretended I was doing. I was 5 years old, I was Anakin Skywalker, I was a nice French boy who'd grow up to be evil. When I finished, they all looked like they'd just seen the puppets come alive. They'd been trying to cast this part for weeks. They'd seen hundreds of people. "Kid," the guy who hated me 5 minutes ago said, "do you have a passport?" They offered to pay me SAG scale, which was $2,500 a week. We were filming at Castel Film Studios in Bucharest, Romania. It was, as the saying goes, a dream come true. I was flying to Bucharest to star in a movie. The Puppet Master people called Iris because now they could call Iris, and loved the fact that they were calling Iris. They were working with Iris. Or so the casting director, with whom I eventually became friends, said to me. He also told me that when they informed Iris I got the part, she said, in shock, "He can actually act?" Iris herself summoned me to her rose-covered Beverly Hills mansion. "Kid," she said, "congratulations." I found myself dearly anticipating the day I would no longer be kid to anyone. "This is a chance. This is a good chance. Do what you can with it. I tried to get you more money. They're not going to give you more money." "It's fine," I said. "I'm not interested in money." She smiled. "You're not allowed to say that ever again." She reached into her desk and pulled out a thick knit hat. "It's cold as hell in Romania. You'll want to wear this. Also, don't fuck your leading lady until the shoot is over, and remember to take your vitamins." She patted me on the cheek and sent me out. Thanksgiving was coming, and I had to get home to see my family. From San Francisco, I'd be flying to Bucharest. When Tommy found out I was coming back to town, he told me he wanted to meet up. I hadn't seen him in almost 4 months. I hadn't told him anything about my film. We met at Virgin Records in San Francisco, per his request. I was excited about the film and wanted to share the good news with him. On top of that, I felt immensely grateful to Tommy, without whom none of this would have happened. Had I never met Tommy, I probably would have still been stuck living with my parents. For some reason, when I was heading out to meet him, I grabbed my football. I think I may have winced when I saw Tommy. He looked dejected, gunned down, burnt out, insomnia plagued. He looked so much worse than the last time I'd seen him, which was saying something. His hair was crusty, his eyes were droopy, and his skin looked pasty and thin. He was wearing sweatpants and flip-flops, and an old white t-shirt that looked like it had been washed within an inch of its life. He gave me an awkwardly complicated bro-fist greeting, but he wouldn't look at me directly. Every glance was furtive, shot from the corner of his eye. Otherwise, he stared at the ground. I suggested we go to Golden Gate Park to play football. Tommy admitted that he'd never played catch, let alone thrown a football before. He claimed to like football, though, much better than soccer. As he shot-putted the ball toward me, his inexperience showed. I asked him how he managed to spend all these years in San Francisco, home of the five-time Super Bowl champion 49ers, and not once throw a football. "Tommy," I said, "Joe Montana would be disappointed in you." To this, Tommy replied, "The Joe Montana is prick." Tommy had no idea who Joe Montana was. It was like he lived in Galilee and had never heard of Jesus. After playing for a while, Tommy announced that we had to go fix his cell phone. We were driving to the cell phone place when I finally told him about the movie. "Oh my God," he said, and pulled the car over. "I need candy." He lunged for a Seize box in his back seat and started to tear into it. I watched him gobble the first couple of chocolates as though they were sedatives. He calmed down eventually, and I think he actually managed to convince himself that he was happy for me. "We go celebrate," he said, turning the car around and leaving his broken cell phone for another, less exultant day. "We go see feature movie." As we sat through Meet Joe Black, I could feel pain and confusion radiating from Tommy in the darkness of the theater. Maybe he felt he was losing me to something. Worse, he was losing me to something he wanted to lose himself in. Tommy was wondering why nothing had happened for him, and why it was happening for me. He didn't want me to outgrow him. He wanted to feel like he was still needed. I didn't know what to say or how to comfort him. After the movie, he dropped me off at Virgin Records, and we said goodbye quickly. A few days later, I flew to Bucharest. We finished production on Christmas Eve, and I went back to my hotel. I remember sitting there on the edge of my bed, taking in the moment, and welcoming the tears filling up my eyes. I replayed the last few months, the last few years. Tomorrow would be Christmas, and I was going to be alone. That was okay, because I felt like I'd been given such an amazing gift. I fell asleep, only to be woken up by someone forcefully knocking on my door, and a Romanian voice saying, "Telegram!" A telegram? I opened it. "Merry Christmas. You are a special person. May all your dreams come true. T.W. I still don't know how Tommy found me. 9. You are tearing me apart, Lisa. The whole place seemed to have been stricken with a kind of creeping paralysis, out of beat with the rest of the world, crumbling apart in slow motion. Joe Gillis, Sunset Boulevard. On the day we were set to shoot the scene in which Johnny and Lisa have a wrenching heart-to-heart about their relationship's long-term feasibility, a scene famous for the line, "You're tearing me apart, Lisa!" Tommy was watching Safua do a wardrobe check on the other actors who'd be filming that day. Robin Paris, who played Michelle, and Juliette Danielle, who played Lisa. As usual, Tommy was micromanaging the situation while skillfully failing to manage much of anything. Safua had decided to dress Lisa in a sleeveless, backless, charmless, powerfully unfortunate red blouse. This blouse did Juliette's body no favors. On top of that, the camera, as they say, adds 10 pounds, which became more like 20 pounds when illuminated by the room's unflattering lighting. When working with a character like Lisa, it's the job of the costume designer and the director to come up with clothing that makes the actor look better than she does in everyday life. In this respect, no one was failed by the room more terribly than Juliette, who was shot and costumed and directed in such a way as to make her a magnitude less attractive, likable, and charming than she was and is. The first time I met Juliette, I thought, this is an incredibly sweet person who's going through a tough, tough time. It was an accurate impression. She'd recently moved to Los Angeles from Texas and was essentially supporting her entire family. She had put her regular day job on hold to do the room. Juliet believed that the room, for which she was paid a pittance, was her one shot at making some real money down the line. The best thing about Juliet was her on-set attitude, which was unfailingly kind and enthusiastic. A lot of times, after shooting, Juliet would go to a nearby karaoke bar and sing with anyone who wanted to join her. The guys on the crew loved Juliet. Once Safua got this awful blouse onto Juliet, Tommy began circling her. He stopped, though, when he came to Juliet's back. There's no other way to say this. Juliet had a few pimples concentrated on one small part of her upper back, which the blouse unforgivingly exposed. Now, there were several ways for Tommy to have handled this. He could have called the makeup person over and asked her, quietly, to make sure Juliet's blemishes got covered up before filming. He could have had Safua put her into a different outfit. What he did was to say loudly enough for everyone to hear, "Excuse me, I'm sorry. We can't have this on the camera." He waved the makeup artist over. "You see all this stuff here? Take this shit out. We can't have this." Juliet knew exactly what Tommy was talking about and started to cry quietly while the makeup artist sprang into action. "This is an American movie," Tommy said over Juliet's desperate sniffling. "It needs to be sexy. She needs to be beautiful." With that, Tommy went off to do his seagull thing elsewhere on set, making a lot of irritating noise while simultaneously shitting on everyone. Juliet was slow to recover from Tommy's cruel treatment. "I'm okay," she said, shaking her head, wiping her tears, her voice brittle and angry. "It's okay, I'm fine." It was obvious she was already at her breaking point. She'd definitely been feeling uneasy around Tommy. Everyone had been. But Tommy treated Juliet more like a daughter than a colleague, and this made their relationship especially uncomfortable given their roles in the film. If, for instance, Tommy caught the scent of cigarettes on Juliet's breath, he'd say, "Do not smoke the cigarettes." If she giggled before a take, he'd tell her to knock off that squeaky stuff and grow up. At times, it really did feel like the most dysfunctional, incestuous relationship this side of Jerry Springer. Tommy's fears about age are embodied in the room's characters. Why would Johnny, an obviously middle-aged man, have a 21-year-old future wife, a 24-year-old best friend, and a bunch of other friends only a few years out of college? With the exception of Lisa's mother, no one in the cast is close to Tommy's age. According to Tommy's script, Lisa is between 21 and 25 and has been with Johnny for either 5 or 7 years. How old, then, was Lisa when she and Johnny got together? A writer less fixated on youth as the ideal state of human existence might have considered that question. I've often been asked why Tommy cast Juliet as Lisa, a character intended to be so heart-slayingly seductive that virtually every male character in the movie loses his mind over her. Maybe no character in the history of film is called beautiful more often than Lisa is. From the very beginning of the room's conceptualization, Tommy said he wanted Lisa to be the biggest thing in the movie, other than him, of course. "She has to be absolutely beautiful," he'd say over and over. "Young, super duper sexy. I want her to be as beautiful as Angelica Jolie." Paging through the Victoria's Secret catalog, he'd say, after every page, "That's perfect, Lisa." The kind of sexiness Tommy wanted Lisa to exhibit is something that's existential. And Juliet was too young, too insecure, and too inexperienced to inhabit such a persona. So Juliet was put into a terrible, unfair situation. And all things considered, I think she handled it well. She's not given nearly enough credit for that. Juliet was set up to fail, and most people in her position would have quit. But Juliet never quit. When Tommy threw a water bottle at the original Michelle, the whole cast walked out. Juliet, though, was disconsolate. She wept. She cared about the movie more than anyone. In the end, Juliet was cast as Lisa because she was the only actress capable of surviving the meat-grinding torture of Tommy's casting process. For Juliet, serial humiliation became just another obstacle to smash through. When I came aboard the USS Room, Juliet had already been cast as Michelle, not as Lisa. The original actress Tommy had settled upon for Lisa was not ideal. Her teeth were discolored from what I assumed had been years of heavy smoking, and she was Latina, with a heavy accent, thus not quite fitting Tommy's vision of an all-American girl. She wasn't unattractive, but viewed through the cruel lens of movie star expectation, she was even less Jolie-like than Juliet. This woman had signed a preliminary contract, though no payment had been discussed. Eventually, after weeks of auditioning and long, unpaid rehearsals, Lisa wanted to know when she'd start filming. One day, she showed up at Burns & Sawyer and demanded some money and a firmer contractual commitment, which somehow offended Tommy. After Tommy brushed off the Lisa, there was a knock at the door. In walked Juliet, who looked at Tommy and me and said, very coolly, "I'd like to start auditioning for Lisa." This was actually a very Lisa-like move for Juliet to pull. As soon as she left, Tommy looked at me with a grin. "Can you imagine? She's very manipulative. Her competition is vicious." Later that day, Tommy sent the Lisa a fax with a world record number of misspellings terminating her contract. This didn't mean that Juliet had an automatic in. Tommy began yet another round of casting calls for Lisa. Some very attractive young women wound up coming in to audition. The first one to show up, Alexis, actually did look like a young Angelina Jolie. Her audition went well. After it was done, she asked me, "So, who's playing Johnny? Has he been cast yet?" I knew if I told her, she'd walk instantly. But she seemed talented and cool enough that I didn't want to waste her time. So I pointed over at Tommy and said, "He's playing Johnny." Alexis looked at Tommy with narrowed, suspicious eyes, as though running through her mind a number of scenarios involving fame and what she was willing to do to have it. "Oh," she said. "Oh." Then she turned back to me. "Yeah, so I don't think I'm going to be able to work this into my schedule. It was really nice meeting you, though." The next few auditions were just as rough. It didn't help that Tommy had placed a bed in the audition room, the same bed he later used in Johnny and Lisa's apartment. Almost every woman who came in needed to be reassured that the room, whatever it wasn't a porno. Meanwhile, Tommy's idea of directing an actress during auditions was to push her in front of a camera and emotionally terrorize her. "Your sister just became lesbian," he'd say, and wait for the acting to kick in. If that didn't work, he'd yell, "Your mother just died." Every actress with confidence or a strong sense of self failed. The few able to withstand Tommy's attitude fled at the first mention that they'd have to lock lips with him. Juliet, though, was willing to kiss Tommy, even though you're barely supposed to kiss in rehearsals. With no contract signed and no camera running, she and Tommy would stand there in rehearsal and make out for minutes. Whenever I told Tommy, "You don't need to go that far," he'd say, "I need to see if they can perform. If they can't perform, I'm sorry, they have to leave. Out. And don't be jealous, young man." After the room was released, my mother commented that to pay $6 million to make out with a girl was pretty pathetic. Once Tommy cast Juliet as Lisa, we had to find someone for the room's other important young woman character, Michelle. After Tommy sacked Brianna, the original Michelle, the production staggered on for some weeks before Tommy realized he needed to think about recasting her. I need a young, beautiful girl, Tommy urged, not some old prune. Well past the point at which finding another Michelle had become an emergency, I yanked a bunch of headshots out of a pile on the floor of Tommy's apartment and started making calls. A few hours later, at 10 p.m., Tommy was surveying a lineup of 18 non-prunes in the Burns and Sawyer parking lot. There was no time to book an audition room, so they all had to perform to the camera in front of one another in the parking lot. In terms of filmmaking, this was the very definition of amateur hour, and they all knew it. It was so bad that I apologized to every actress the moment she finished her audition. My apologies weren't good enough for some actresses near the back of the dwindling casting line. When Tommy had unkind things to say about one actress's audition, the last three women in line looked at one another in disgust and walked off the lot. This left us with four actresses, the first three of whom couldn't survive Tommy telling them their sisters had just become lesbians. The last woman up, Robin Paris, was a newly married graduate of Duke University who'd been doing commercial work in Los Angeles. The first thing I noticed about her was her unbelievably genuine smile. She didn't ask any questions before doing her scene. She just walked up to the camera and did it. She was easily the best person we saw, and she didn't even have to be told that her mother was dead. "Wow," Tommy said. "Beautiful. Very nice. So we make you a few part?" Robin's amazing smile got even bigger, but I could tell she was thrown. This wasn't how directors talk to actors during auditions. For all sorts of practical and emotional reasons, most directors remain very sphinxy and poker-faced with actors during auditions. "Okay," she said. "We will let you know. We need you to perform the kissing stuff. Are you giving? Can you make it here tomorrow?" "Sure," Robin said, still smiling, but far more cautiously now. I don't think she fully understood him. "Then maybe we see you tomorrow." Talking to an auditioning actor in this way, promising and unpromising, give a thing and take a thing away, is basically a form of abuse. But Robin left in what seemed to be good spirits. The second she was off the set, Tommy told me to hire her. I gave it a half hour, called her, and told her when to show up the next day. The crew was knocked out by Robin. Sandy compared her to Julia Roberts, which wasn't an insane comparison to make. Both had smiles that hit you like sunlight off a mirror, and Robin actually knew which end was up on a movie set. Having ascertained from her audition experience that the room's wardrobe budget would be limited, she brought in her own clothes. She'd also done her own makeup. Within 20 minutes of arriving on set, she was rehearsing, learning the crew people names, and generally charming everyone in sight. As the production went on, Robin would come to me and ask, politely, why she wasn't being paid according to how much time she was spending on set. I tried to explain, equally politely, that the room was on something called Tommy time. Jokes like that only made Robin more skeptical. "If I'm here for 6 hours," she'd say, "is it a 6-hour rate or does it qualify as overtime?" I had no good answer to such reasonable questions and couldn't press Tommy to provide one. Eventually, like everyone, Robin gave in. It was a job. She was getting tape and experience. For all of Tommy's issues with women, it should be said that he does try throughout the room to provide his female characters with emotions and activities he regards as realistic. Unfortunately, these womanly emotions and activities usually involve sitting around, shopping, drinking wine, gossiping, getting banged, or some combination thereof. Tommy's female characters have no inner dimension at all. They're idealized, but half-heartedly. From Tommy's artistic perspective, a woman is someone who's supposed to be on the couch when a man gets home, someone who's supposed to know to order her man a pizza when he has a bad day, someone who's been trained to regard a dozen roses as a gift of universe-exploding significance. The scene immediately preceding Johnny and Lisa's heart-to-heart was filmed the day after Robin had been hired and the day of Juliet's back acne catastrophe. All of Tommy's ideas about women are at play. The women have apparently just returned home from shopping. "Did you get a new dress?" Johnny asks when he enters the scene. They're being manipulative. Lisa tells Michelle that Johnny hits her, but good news, she's also found somebody else. And they're guzzling Merlot. Tommy was watching Sandy instruct Robin and Juliet on the living room set. I could tell that Sandy was having a good time. He was calling Juliet Jules and flirting shamelessly with Robin. I noticed that whenever Robin was around, Sandy would begin talking about things like the monstrous project I just did at Universal. For a few moments, it felt like an actual film scene was coming together. It wasn't. The scene Robin and Juliet wound up shooting is riddled with continuity errors. Throughout the scene, for instance, Lisa puts her wine glass down in one shot, but is still holding it in another. Even worse is the alarming thing that starts happening to Juliet's neck when she becomes animated toward the end of the scene. The cords in her neck begin popping out against her skin, as though the alien from Alien were trying to fight its way out of her jugular. Her unfortunate blouse didn't help, putting her throat machinery on full display. I suspect this neck poppage was a result of the contorted way she was forced to sit. I leave any more granular explanation to an anatomist. Other than Lisa's awful red blouse, an apparently exploding neck, and the dozen or so continuity errors, Robin and Juliet's scene came off without a hitch. Now it was Tommy's turn to enter the scene. Because I was one of the only people involved in the production who'd seen the entire room script, I knew this scene, in which Johnny melts down in front of Lisa, had at least one incandescent mistake in it. This mistake concerned Johnny's biggest line in the film. "You are tearing me apart, Lisa!" That's not what the original script said, though. The line in the original script read, "You are taking me apart, Lisa." Tommy stole, or rather tried and failed to steal, the "tearing me apart" line from Rebel Without a Cause, spoken by James Dean's character, Jim Stark, who is drunk and lashing out at his parents. Naturally, Tommy loved this scene, the power and sheer balls-out emotional savagery of it. It's a moment where viewers don't really know whether they're watching a movie or an entire generation coalesce. Occasionally, I wonder if The Room was not conceived and written just so Tommy could have this elemental, unbridled moment of performance. Which makes it even weirder that Tommy still managed to fuck up the line in his script. No one involved in The Room had caught this gaffe, because no one but I had any idea how much James Dean meant to Tommy. Meanwhile, Tommy's version of the line has 100 times more hits on YouTube than James Dean's version, which, quite frankly, makes me feel like I'm being torn apart. In the scene's opening, Johnny sits on a chair across from Lisa. The first thing Sandy noticed when Tommy sat down was that a table in the background was distractingly empty. "We can't just shoot a blank table," Sandy said. It wasn't the first time it had come up that Johnny and Lisa's condo had all the charm of my room at the Saharan Motel. How did Tommy come to furnish his film's imaginary condo? By walking into a thrift furniture store in LA and purchasing the entire mock-up apartment in its display windows. This means that Johnny and Lisa's condo was modeled on a space purposefully designed to be uninhabited. Early in the production, Sandy offered Tommy the use of his own house to film the interiors, so as to avoid moments like these. He even brought in pictures for Tommy to consider. "Look," Sandy said, "it would be so much easier. We don't have to have all these props or all these people around. Everything could be done much more quickly. We'd be in and out in a couple of days." Tommy refused, later telling me, "If Sandy takes over, he has control. I know what he does. He wants more money. Plus, I'm sorry, his house is Mickey Mouse." Sandy was still staring at the blank table behind Tommy and Juliet. Where, he wanted to know, is the art department? The art department, which was comprised of Merce and a revolving door of stagehands, volunteered that the budget didn't really allow for comprehensive, realistic decoration, and moreover, no one had told her to fill the tables with knick-knackery. Tommy took command of the situation and sent the art department down Highland Avenue to a framing shop. A little later, they returned with sample frames, all glorified with stock photos of spoons. Tommy, over Sandy's and the art department's objections, told them to use the frame spoons for the simple reason that he wanted to get on with filming. I don't think the most gifted prognosticator could have predicted the fateful impact of this impatience-born split-second decision, much less the volleys of plastic spoons that room audience members would later throw whenever these sad little stock photo spoons appear on screen. To the photographer tasked with the tedious job of snapping those spoon pictures, take heart. Your work has not been wasted. Now that the frame spoons were in place, Tommy got back to the demanding, if familiar, task of not remembering any of his lines. Shooting the first part of Johnny and Lisa's conversation took longer than it should have. But given that it wasn't a huge acting moment for Tommy, he was able to relax and, with effort, eventually grind out his lines. When Tommy was faced with the pressure of nailing the argumentative, taking-me-apart moment of Johnny and Lisa's conversation, however, he came unglued. Johnny's declaration of, "I cannot go on without you," was where the problems began. Tommy would move as far into the dialogue as, "I cannot go on," and get confused and call out, "Line." Sandy would then dutifully feed him the rest. "Without you. I cannot go line on without you. I cannot line. Tommy, for God's sake, I cannot go on without you. Okay, thank you. Action. I cannot go on line." The crew's mutinous mockery of Tommy began. Raphael, our director of photography, had by now retreated to the special tent he'd set up at the edge of the set. This allowed him to pretend to watch Tommy's performance on the monitor while he giggled so hard the tent sometimes shook. Line, 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 over and over again. It became hard to accept. Unlike the scene in which Tommy emerged from the outhouse, he wasn't doing anything in this scene. It wasn't like he had to walk and talk at the same time. He was just standing there, looking at Juliet. Tommy eventually made it to the line, "You're lying, I never hit you," which wound up sounding like, "You're lying, I never hit you." This, despite Sandy's repeated request for a better, cleaner take. Not that it mattered. Virtually none of Tommy's captured audio performance was usable, given the sound crew's inexperience and the fact that they had to keep stopping and starting during Tommy's takes to load more film. I was reclining nearby on the floor next to Amy, the makeup artist. Tommy came over and squatted next to us. "I don't need you to talk to her," he said, as though Amy didn't exist. "I need you to watch the screen and help me." "I can help you from here." "No, you can't. Come with me to monitor." We went over to Raphael's giggle tent. Sandy was there with him. "How'd these come out?" Tommy asked Raphael. "Great," he said. I followed with, "Perfect, keep going." What else, at this point, could anyone tell him? "Oh, you just say that," Tommy said, and left me, Raphael, and Sandy alone in the giggle tent. "Where is he from, anyway?" Raphael asked me. "Where does he say he's from?" "New Orleans," I said. Close-up time. Time, in other words, for Tommy to say, "You're taking me apart, Lisa," with the camera right in his face. When Tommy made his first go at the shot, a few people on set recognized the attempted reference to Rebel, but no one had the heart to tell him he was mangling the line. "My arm's gone," crew people started calling out. "Stop taking me apart." Tommy became agitated and angry in the manner of someone with an itch he'd lost all hope of scratching. I'd mentioned to Safua that Tommy had gotten the line wrong. She took me aside and said, "You should really tell him, Greg. Really, you should." She was right. So I took Tommy aside, looked at him squarely, and told him he had the line wrong. It was tearing and not taking. Oh, Tommy said. I was surprised by how calmly he absorbed this news. It turned out that was just camouflage, because the first thing Tommy did was turn around and yell at the slate person for picking up his jacket off the floor. He followed that up by telling the camera people what a terrible job they were doing. I see your camera work, Tommy scoffed, and you need to do a better job. One of the cameraman's assistants, who was charged with doing the lens, spent the rest of his tenure on the room saying, just trying to do a better job, whenever Tommy gave anyone camera-related direction. Tommy returned to the heady task of saying, you are tearing me apart, Lisa. He was still having trouble. Sandy had given up hope, and Juliet was laughing in Tommy's face. Tommy was so consumed with getting the line right that he didn't seem to notice. Keep rolling, damn it, he told the cameraman, take after blown take. Then, suddenly, Tommy got it. He said it, his arms thrusting up like terrible mallets. You are tearing me apart, Lisa! Sandy, who was sitting on an apple crate, had not been expecting this. Cut, he said, springing up. Cut! Tommy was veiny with exertion. He stood there, breathing, pointlessly triumphant. For a moment, it looked like his head might actually explode. James Dean wept.
10. Do you have the guts to take me? Well, whatever you do, however terrible and however hurtful, it all makes sense, doesn't it? In your head. Tom Ripley, the talented Mr. Ripley. Upon my return from Romania to L.A., I discovered that someone had spent considerable time in my apartment while I was gone. All the cupboards in the kitchen were open. Dirty dishes were piled in the sink. Someone had dragged in a small roll-out bed and left it in the living room. There were numerous long black hairs in the tub. Most troubling, an envelope containing my check for Retro Puppet Master was sitting on my desk. It had been opened. I'd spoken with Tommy briefly a few weeks ago from France, where I'd met up with an old girlfriend after Retro wrapped. During that conversation, he hadn't mentioned anything about being in Los Angeles, much less being in the apartment. He did, however, ask me if I was doing sex with the girl I was seeing. After I came to grips with the fact that Tommy had been here and opened my mail, I discovered another strange thing. Nowhere in my monthly Bank of America statements was there any indication that Tommy had been cashing my $200 rent checks, which I'd been sending him for months. I got him on the phone immediately. I'm listening. Tommy, I said, did you come to L.A. while I was gone?
I have a meeting there, and I don't want to upset you, but you are a messy person. You have no plans, no nothing, no life.
Messy? I hadn't moved anything into or changed anything about Tommy's place, having no idea how long I'd be living there. Did you, I asked him, open my mail?
On accident. I open your check on accident.
On accident?
I'm sorry, my God, you're so sensitive.
I could tell this seemed fun to him.
Check is big secret, I guess. By the way, welcome home to the USA to you.
This was the first time I hung up on Tommy. I understand that he was curious to learn how much I got paid for Retro Puppet Master. He was probably also dying to know who my agent was. But opening my mail, and then not even trying to hide the fact that he had, that was worrisome. And why on earth was he even in L.A.? I was quite certain by now that any meetings he had were imaginary. I could spend all day puzzling over Tommy's machinations, but I had better things to do, such as call Iris and Chris and figure out what was next. When I called Iris, she told me she'd seen Patch Adams and that I had, in fact, made the final cut. Maybe, she said, he'll get nominated for Best Supporting Actor. After that little zinger, she said something much more helpful. Get ready. I'm going to open doors for you. It's up to you to do something with it. True to her word, Iris began getting me meteor auditions. Working in Romania had given me a taste of what it was like to make a movie. I hoped it would be the start of something more. With that expectation came a lot of scary internal pressure. I was shocked to realize how much more pleasant it was to feel like an underdog. My first month back in LA was January, pilot season, often the busiest time for young actors. As the auditions piled up, I recognized how easy I'd had it until now. Even if you're lucky enough to land a great agent, as I had, getting called in was hard, getting called back was really hard, and getting cast was even harder than that. Then came the hardest part of all, being in something that people actually saw. I tried not to get discouraged. Some days I felt certain I was close to breaking through. Other days I felt like I was one of literally millions of people throwing themselves up against the same cold, indifferent wall. In the middle of all this, Tommy was leaving me at least 2 messages a day. His messages had always been pretty out there, but now they became somehow aggressively out there. Hey, yo! I just saw this movie, The Firm. You run exactly like the Tom Cruise, for your information. Or, hey lady, shut up! What movie is this from? I challenge you. Or, I eat oranges in bed now. Feels so good. You should try it sometime with your French girl. Call me! My message machine was so ancient that it didn't allow me to skip ahead through the Tommy-a-thons. I had to endure all his weird messages before finding out if I'd gotten any responses to my auditions. It was driving me crazy. I was happy to learn that the Retro Puppet Master production team had cut together a 90-second reel of some of my scenes from the film, which I could use as a demo. They'd even gone so far as to score the demo to classical music. It was much more elaborate than I'd expected, and they gave me many more copies than I needed. I was extremely grateful. Because the footage had a period feel, however, Iris and I edited it to conclude with some of my headshots to show different looks. She didn't want me to be typecast as a period piece, puffy shirt guy with a French accent. Tommy's messages became more insistent. It's urgent, Greg. Urgent. Call me. I knew perfectly well it wasn't urgent, but I was living in Tommy's apartment and I felt I owed him a call. Hey, yo, he said, since you are now the expert, how'd you become member of the SAG? This was his urgent business? You mean SAG? Yeah, you know, SAG, ha. I'd always found it amusing when Tommy tried to be condescending, but right now I wasn't in the mood. I know SAG, Tommy. Yeah, I know. Your IQ is 190. So come on, expert. Tell me, how do you get the SAG card? I sighed. You need to have either 3 vouchers as an extra, certain amount of hours, or be a principal in a commercial.
Principal commercial? Why don't you help me? Be specific.
Tommy, it's pretty clear. I just said it. You need to be a principal in a commercial, like a speaking role or something. I could tell he was writing all this down and felt my heart crack a little. When he was done writing, Tommy said,
okay then. Thank you. So how is Big Star? How is the Puppet Master coming?
It's cool. I did some voiceover stuff for post-production today, and they cut a little reel for me.
Reel? Tommy said. Like the demo reel?
Yeah.
I want to see right away, he said excitedly. Mail to me, I pay for it.
Tommy seemed more psyched about my demo reel than I was, so I sent him a copy. A few days later, he called again to say,
I'm watching your reel now. I watched it 12 times so far.
I was, I admit, somewhat concerned for him. I was equally concerned for me. I tried to laugh this excessiveness off. Tommy, it's a padded beginner's reel.
No, no, don't put yourself down. It's very good. I love beginning part with all the candles. Very powerful.
There was a scene in Retro where I walk up a flight of stairs lined with white candles. It was far and away the cheesiest moment in the reel. That Tommy was so affected by it made me even more worried about its inclusion. Tommy had some criticisms, though.
Why are you tilting on the staircase? Why you have this stupid French accent that doesn't sell in America, you know? Forget this stupid French. Also, your hair is donut again. But overall, you did excellent job. The pictures at the end are great. Who take your pictures? Which photographer? Or is it big secret?
As I was hanging up, I heard, on Tommy's end of the line, the sound of the music used up at the beginning of my reel start up again. I had a worrying mental picture of Tommy sitting up all night watching it. A few weeks later, Tommy surprised me with an announcement that he was coming to LA the next day for yet another important meeting. He also said he had something big to show me. I had no idea what to expect. When he arrived, I was having a phone meeting with Michael Landon Jr. We were talking about the possibility of my playing him in an ABC movie based on his life. I'd already been in once to read for the part, and had a good feeling after hearing Michael's comments. Our phone meeting was also going well. Then Tommy arrived. He stood mugging in the doorway while I tried to conduct my phone business. When I didn't pay any attention to his grand arrival, Tommy started to preen and say, "Somebody's cranky today." He ignored my shoo-away hand signals and went on to say, loudly, that while parking, he bashed into the car in front of him and he didn't know what to do. I could tell that Michael Landon Jr. was wondering who the lunatic was talking in the background on my end of the line. I quickly hand-signaled silence to Tommy and went into the bedroom and closed the door. When I opened the door, Tommy was beside himself with giddiness.
"Look at me," he said,
gesturing down at his baggy waterbed salesman suit.
"I feel like businessman Big Shark today."
"How was your meeting?" I asked him, concentrating on not being agitated. Tommy held up a binder of papers.
"I have exciting news," he said,
handing them over to me.
"I have joined the SAG."
I looked at these papers and concluded that, indeed, Tommy was now a dues-paid SAG member. "Congratulations," I said, stunned. Tommy began striking a conquering hero pose.
"You know what? I say if this guy can do it, I do it too. You challenge me. Remember, I'm not your competition. Don't be jealous."
I knew how important this was to Tommy. For him, getting into SAG was as significant as landing a part in a Clint Eastwood film. It meant he was respectable and no longer spinning his wheels. I didn't have the heart to tell him that, in the grand scheme of things, becoming a member of SAG was the easy part. So instead, I said, "How'd you do it, anyway?"
"I wasn't going to show you," Tommy said, walking over to the television. "But why not?"
He had with him a VHS tape, which he pushed into his ancient VCR. I had to wipe the dust from the television screen just to see the picture. The tape began, and there was Tommy, in colorful quasi-Shakespearean garb, standing on a staircase and holding a candelabra filled with lit candles, while classical music played in the background. His opening line, "To be or not to be, that is the question." It was a commercial for street fashions that he'd written, filmed, and produced himself. Almost every visual and thematic aspect of this commercial had been swiped from my demo reel. I was speechless. Tommy had bought himself SAG membership. The commercial was hilarious in all sorts of ways, beginning with his citation of "to be or not to be," which Tommy regarded as one of Shakespeare's insta profundities, not realizing that the line is about whether or not to commit suicide. Kill yourself or not at street fashions. When it ended, I wondered if Tommy's commercial had sent the SAG people deep into their application's fine print jungle, searching for something, anything, to prevent this Shakespearean denim peddler from joining their ranks. Then Tommy rewound the tape and played it again. When the commercial ended for the second time, I cast about for the right words. But I didn't have to worry. Tommy rewound the thing and played it again. When it was over, he looked at me, smiling, wanting to know what I thought. While I knew what I thought, I still had no idea what to say. I had to give him credit for one thing, though. He did exactly as I'd suggested. He'd earned his SAG membership. "That was really well done," I said. "Great job." Then we watched it again. "So," Tommy said, after the fourth playthrough, "do you like candles?" "Yeah," I said. "Very creative." "But is it great? How is my voice? What age do you think? Be specific. How it compared to yours?" He said all this so innocently. Did Tommy even know what he was doing? "It's great," I said, my voice soft and cold. I had to get out of that apartment. I was worried we'd have to watch his commercial 12 more times. I suggested we get away from the VCR and go somewhere, anywhere else. Tommy, after changing clothes, suggested we celebrate his SAG triumph by heading up to the observatory at Griffith Park. He'd always wanted to see the place where the knife fight from Rebel Without a Cause was filmed. I got lost on the way to the observatory. "Babyface," Tommy said, shaking his head. "Never change." Part of the reason I got lost was that I was constantly checking my cell phone to see if my agent had called with any good news, which Tommy noticed. "Greg," he said, "these people don't care about you. All these advisors you have, they will not do shit for you. You give them too much credit." Then Tommy said, "So, who is your agent, anyhow? Do they need new people?" "I don't know," I said. "I doubt they do shit for you, either." Tommy laughed, and I laughed, and at that moment it actually felt fun hanging out with him again. Once we reached the observatory, Tommy went to work in staging a Tommy and Greg reenactment of Rebel's knife fight in the exact place where it had been shot in 1955. He even found a guy to take our picture. After one snap, the guy tried to give Tommy his camera back, but Tommy wanted more pictures. "I need more. Now tell me, does it look like real fight?" He started giving the poor man all this complicated direction. Tommy finally let his conscripted cameraman get back to his hike. We stood there at the base of the observatory, looking out over the microchip grids of Greater Los Angeles. "You know what?" Tommy said. "Maybe I move to Los Angeles." These were the words I'd been fearing the most. Was that his hint that I needed to move out? Had my start in Los Angeles roused Tommy's competitive side? Had Tommy allowed me to stay in his LA apartment in the hope I could pave the way to his becoming an actor? Was I just his LA crash test dummy? ACT, SAG, his demo reel. I was starting to see a clear pattern. If he moved to LA, I had to move out. I obviously couldn't live with Tommy, but my savings weren't enough to pay for a decent apartment on my own. I'd have to get more than a part-time job. But being an unemployed actor was a job, a full-time job at that. Tommy didn't mention moving to LA again, and later that day, he went back to San Francisco. I didn't end up playing Michael Landon Jr. The casting director in charge of the Landon movie did, however, bring me back in to read for something called Lord of the Rings, where I learned I was too tall to play something called a hobbit. Needless to say, I wasn't a big fantasy fiction reader as a kid. I made the mistake of writing down the number of auditions I'd been on since returning from Romania. 50. Of those 50 auditions, I got called back in for around 12 or 13. I was told this was a pretty good percentage. In other words, I was doing great at being an unemployed actor. I was desperately trying not to look desperate when I went in to read, which didn't help when most of the parts I was reading for were Dawson's Creek ripoffs, which I was wrong for. Iris and Chris were telling me to hang in there, that she was getting a good response, but she didn't seem to be returning my calls as quickly as she used to. Pilot season was about results, and callbacks weren't results. "I want to hear about the collisions," Iris would say, "and not the near misses." To improve my odds, I signed on with a manager whom some of Iris's clients, including one of her biggest, worked with. Getting a manager doesn't mean losing an agent. A manager takes a more hands-on approach. A manager coaches you, gives you stern career advice, and sometimes even drives you to auditions, especially if you're a young actor with a crappy car. From what I'd heard, my new manager was renowned for being a terrific audition coach. Thus, I was a little disappointed when her initial advice amounted to some superstitious gunk about arranging my desk in a certain way while learning my lines. To her credit, though, she almost immediately got me an audition for Scream 3, a part in a workshop version of Hamlet at the NoHo Arts Center, and a screen test for a sports movie in Palo Alto. Over the next few months, Tommy was always updating me on his activities, which sounded to me like he was preparing a full-on actor's assault of Los Angeles. He was taking voice classes at ACT, doing a scene study thing with Gene Shelton, learning Shakespeare at some place I'd never heard of, and getting headshots taken by at least 4 different photographers. Whenever we talked now, he'd say he had to go. He wanted to keep his line open in case anyone called about his available acting services. He'd say this, mind you, when he called me. One day I found in my mail a huge dump of Tommy headshots, at least 50 different versions. They were all professionally done, obviously expensive, and rather scary. He must have dropped thousands of dollars on these headshots. Soon enough, he called, wanting my opinion. My own grim prospects had begun to erode my spirit, and I found myself saying things to him on the phone I wasn't sure I even believed. "Acting's not just about taking classes," I said. "It's about luck, first and foremost. Then it's about marketing yourself, fitting the parts, and having contacts. It's just a business." Tommy resisted all this. "I don't want to hear about the luck. What about my headshots?" I held up one and looked at it. In the shot, Tommy was unsmiling, duck-lipped, and wearing an unbuttoned shirt. His hair was pinned in the back, making him look like an old woman with no makeup and a bad dye job. "Okay, I'm looking at one right now. Can I be honest?"
"Of course, I want you to be honest."
"You're showing a repellent side of yourself in these photos. This isn't the Tommy I know. You look scary when you're trying to look all suave or something." I picked up another one that resembled Dracula doing a fashion shoot for Jean-Paul Gaultier's less talented cousin. The only casting directors who'd be willing to call Tommy in on the basis of this headshot were the ones curious about what it was like to be murdered. I asked Tommy. Have you ever thought of smiling in any of these photos?
Are you kidding me? I need to be dramatic.